I'm just saying, he made a bigger comeback than bloody Easter Sunday.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast at the Giro d'Italia in association with Rafa. From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee stops, Rafa exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport. Today we are in Cervinia.
Cozze ci tene, cozze, cozze vicine, nu spicudeci cora, nu spicudeci cora. Cozze ci tene, cozze, cozze vicine, nu spicudeci cora, se nu mangiano le femmine.
Well, we opened there with a clip from George Bennett, who was talking to you this morning, Daniel. Where are we and what was he talking about?
Well, Rich,
two questions.
We are in the Val d'Aosta. That's the region we're in of Italy. And this morning we're in Susa. George Bennett was talking to me about a bit of a firestorm that had been created overnight because yesterday when he came in after the stage, he seemed to liken Chris Froome's miraculous comeback to Floyd Landis's in the 2006 Tour de France. Well, understandably, I have to say, to a certain extent, people had got the wrong end of the stick. Anyway,
a lot of knickers in a twist.
We're halfway down the mountain. We're halfway down the climb. What was the climb to Cervinia? Cervinia being the resort under the Matterhorn. The Matterhorn, which is called the Cervino in Italian. I spoke to quite a lot of people today on the race, direct to sportifs, who didn't know that the mountain towering above our heads was the Matterhorn, the second most famous mountain in the Alps, I would suggest. The inspiration for Toblerone.
Indeed.
I've got some great Toblerone-related cycling stories, cycling-related Toblerone stories, but we won't go into them now.
Are they as factual as your fruit stories, Daniel?
Oh, the fruit stories. And we've already mentioned one kiwi, George Bennett. We're going to mention kiwis again now.
Corrections,
because I made a gaffe, didn't I?
Mm.
I said that Italy was the biggest producer of kiwi fruits in the world. It's the biggest exporter of kiwi fruits. It's the second biggest producer in the world,
really,
after China.
But China produces so many that kiwi they're mainly fruits, for the
Chinese must eat a lot of kiwi fruits. Anyway.
Wow. Extraordinary stuff. Somebody actually messaged us to say that kiwi fruits help you sleep. That might be why Tom Dumoulin is scoffing them. Tale of the Tapa. Should we have the tale of the tapa? Stage 20.
Always my favourite bit of the podcast.
Stage 20, Susa to Cervinia, 214 kilometres. Well, you're going to pay attention, aren't you, this time, Daniel, because you don't know what happened today. Early start.
Harsh.
10 past 10. The very early start for the Giro, but they want to finish early in order to get to Rome. The break went away with Ilia Viviani in it, no less. He was among five riders who were then joined by 22 others at 39 kilometres. They carved out a lead of about 3 minutes. Astana then started chasing. A big day for them, defending Miguel Angel Lopez's white jersey, but also trying to get him onto the podium, which in the event they did. Viviani, no surprises here, won the intermediate sprint. Very fast, 45 kilometres an hour over the first 3 hours of racing.
Rich, can you tell me, I don't want to put you in a difficult spot here, but can you tell me, was that intermediate sprint relevant to the Ciclamino jersey?
Well, the answer to that is, I'm not sure. I think his lead is enough over Sam Bennett. It's pretty convincing, but I haven't done the math.
But we're doing tomorrow.
Do I look like Lionel Burney?
Tomorrow, we're doing a full roundup minor competitions, including things like the Fuga d'Italia, whatever they call it, the Traguardo Volante, the Super Fast Team Italia, all these.
I wouldn't call minor
slightly competitions. Well, some of them are slightly obscure.
Anyway, as they began the first climb, they call Secori.
I was discussing this with Marco Pinotti, who, of course, is Italian.
Mm.
How do you pronounce names in the Val d'Aosta? Because it's trilingual, the Val d'Aosta.
It's very French, isn't it?
Very French. Well, Italian and French are official languages, but so is the local dialect. So there are actually three official languages of the Val d'Aosta. So we're not really sure how you pronounce the
names. Lionel did warn me about you interrupting the tale of the Tapa, but that was probably justified. 11 riders remained at the front, including Michael Woods, who's very unwell. He sounds very sick and is battling on. Matej Moric, Giovanni Visconti, among some others. Mikel Nievi was there, as Robert Hessink as well. The gap now 4 to 5 minutes. On the second climb, the Col San Pantaleon, Thibaut Pinot began to struggle, which was a surprise after his strong ride yesterday. Up front, Nievi went clear on the penultimate climb of the day with Grosschartner and De Brambilla. But Nievi attacked them and went over the top on his own, as he would continue to finish to take a victory on his 34th birthday.
Rich, can I interrupt again?
Uh-huh.
bitter, a kind of bitter irony that Thibaut Pinot struggled today and struggled where he did, because these are precisely the roads and the mountains where he first kind of made a name for him in Italian cycling when he won the Giro della Valdosta a few years ago, and that was one of his big breakthroughs as an amateur rider. And he loves riding in the, he loves racing the Valdosta.
Not today, he didn't. What we were all waiting for, the climb to Cervinia. It was a climb that we thought suited Tom Dumoulin, and he launched the first of his many anticipated attacks, about between eight and nine kilometers from the top, we think. It was okay, but I think, you know, when you see a big lorry trying to overtake another big lorry on the motorway, it was a bit like that. He's not exactly, you know, no, he's not exactly lightning fast. He's big and powerful, and you know, the chances of him being able to jump away on a climb are not big.
But it was his.
It's only the only thing he could really do.
But it was his kind of climb, and you know, just speaking to the guys at Sunweb this morning, they, you know, you could formulate all sorts of ideas about what they might try, something equivalent to what Sky tried yesterday, for example. But they were pretty sure that the only chance Dumoulin had, what was, he was either a collapse from Froome or a big attack towards the end of this Cervinia climb. And it was a climb that when the route was announced last autumn, there were a few climbs that Tom Dumoulin immediately thought would suit him. The Mercogliano climb at the end of the first week, Prato Nervoso the other day, and Cervinia. So, you know, the odds looked quite good in that respect, but Froome is obviously, he's obviously come into form.
Dumoulin was brought back. He had about four goes, but never really got much of a gap. Froome was able to recover pretty well. Sam Omen was there for Tom Dumoulin, his some teammate, and did a great job just riding on the front, keeping the pace fairly high. And Froome was isolated for a while, but White Poles got back on, so then he wasn't isolated anymore. In the end, Dumoulin trailed off towards the finish, lost six more seconds, so he is 46 seconds down going into Froome. He is 46 seconds down going into Rome for the final
cycling
stage.
Cycling podcast is nothing but polished production.
Oh, that'll be edited out, don't you worry. There were huge time gaps again. Pino came in with the Gruppetto, 45 minutes down. There were 83 riders in the Gruppetto, which is over half the field. Lopez moved up to third. He will win the white jersey. Carapaz up to fourth. Pots of Evil, fifth. A good day for him after a bad day yesterday. The Alazobeldia Award will go to Pello Bilbao, who is currently six overall. We'll do all the other competitions tomorrow, but Team Sky will win the team classification, and Chris Froome will win the mountains classification as well. So, you know, a few days ago we thought Team Sky once again failed at the Giro, and they've turned it around into a tremendous success. And as we spoke about at length last night, Froome's ride was either one for the record books and one to glory in, or it was one to be sceptical about. And opinion seems to be very divided on that. Certainly if you look at social media, it's quite extraordinary.
Shall we wistfully go back in time to this morning when we discussed whether Froome's performance was
We asked what people thought about what their impressions were.
And our starting point, Rich, was that video, now infamous video, featuring George Bennett that his own team filmed and posted last night, in which George Bennett said that Chris Froome had done a Landis. Floyd Landis doing a Landis, that of course is synonymous with Floyd Landis's miraculous comeback at Morzine in the 2006 Tour de France, when he'd lost a lot of time just before that, turned it around with, he gained 6 or 7 minutes, didn't he, at Morzine. And of course, subsequently tested positive for testosterone and was stripped of his Tour de France victory. So doing a Landis is a bit of a problematic expression. But George Bennett felt that he'd been misinterpreted, and his is the first voice we're going to hear.
Who was the last guy that made an epic comeback? Here's a question for you. I'm going to answer your question with a question. Tell me, who was the last guy that made an epic comeback?
The ginger-haired, an American, and a man.
Who was it?
Floyd Landis.
Okay, I'm not saying he railed a bunch of gear because he. I'm just saying that was the last comeback. And if we can't compare to another cyclist, we can't make a comparison to any cyclist in the last 20 years. Otherwise, that means, like, you're just drawing. I didn't say Froome went out and railed a bunch of gear and came back and won the stage. I'm just saying, he made a bigger comeback than bloody Easter Sunday. And I think, like, I'm not saying at all, there's no innuendo, there's no, I'm not inferring anything, but if we can't make comparisons to cycling, we can't compare to Pantani, we can't compare to Merckx then, because, you know, we don't know what was going on there, and it's nothing to do with drugs or anything like that. But it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy. People on Twitter, they want it to mean what they want it to mean, you know, and they think that I'm in there batting for them.
Gianni Savio, Androni Giocattoli team manager.
Wonderful. Wonderful, and remembering the old cycling, old romantic side.
I agree with Team Sunweb. Strong.
Markel Irizar, Trek Segafredo.
Chapeau. Chapeau. I think the big champions, there are many guys that they criticize him. You know, for me, he show big balls. Respect, you know, for sure he has a big pressure with all that is coming around him to attack. How he attacked, his show is not that he has class, also that he has balls, and for me, chapeau for a big champion.
Chris Hamilton, Team Sunweb. What can you say? It was a gutsy ride, yeah.
Didn't see that one coming.
No, I don't think anyone did, but I don't know, he must have had his Wheaties in the morning or something. A good breakfast.
I'm Alex Dowser of Team Katusha Alpecin.
You know Chris Froome reasonably well, I would imagine. What did you make of his performance yesterday?
That's phenomenal. I watched all the Team Sky videos afterwards about how they orchestrated yesterday, and yeah, they're completely right. I mean, take away all of the other shit that's going on about Froome, just focus on exactly what they did yesterday. They took an exceptional athlete, they analysed the stage, and they just did things better than everyone else did, and that was how he was able to. So I know, like me, 38 minutes behind, I underfueled. The franticness of the first part meant I was on the back leg right from the start. It's it's Team Sky. They do things. Yeah, they've had a lot of bad press lately, but they, right from when they were first formed, they came in to do cycling better than everyone else has done it, and that's, I think they showed that yesterday.
George Preidler, and I ride for Groupama FDJ. Nobody expected that. I think it was extraordinary effort. I think not many people can do that, what he did. It's impressive, very impressive.
Dan Hakkenberg, Algemeen Dagblad, Dutch Press. It's not strange nowadays that with the recent history of cycling, we are a bit skeptical by performances like we've seen with Chris Froome the day before, how he took over the Giro. I think the only thing we should do as journalists in these sort of races is ask people about it, and even ask the key players about it. So what I did yesterday, I asked Dave Brailsford and today Chris Froome if this ride and this Giro victory will stand, and they both answered yes. That's the least thing we can do with all in mind what happened the last 20, 25 or maybe 50 years.
So some interesting opinions there.
What do you make of the whole George Bennett episode, Rich? I mean, I think a lot of people here at the race and some people working for other teams were pretty surprised that Lotto Jumbo A, posted the clip, B, have kept it up there, C, almost drew attention to it by posting a disclaimer. Already last night.
I think from George Bennett's point of view, he is, 28 years old? In his lifetime of following cycling, that's probably his reference points will be, it'll be Floyd Landis when you talk about long escapes. We can remember a few more, and we know of others in history, from Eddie Merckx to Fausto Coppi to whatever. That would be his one. When you talk about long distance escapes like that, you know the Floyd Landis one is the one that springs most easily to mind.
But I think
now he's not, you know, and I think that's possibly why he said it.
He also hit the nail on the head in terms of people, not just on social media, but people using sound bites or circumstances to fit a narrative that they believe in.
What I'm curious about is what's the theory? What, I mean, all these people who cry foul, what is the theory? That Chris Froome swallowed some magic potion the night before the stage. I mean, that's not ridiculous because that's what we think Floyd
that has
Landers
happened.
Did.
Yeah, that has happened.
But you know, is that the theory? I've read that he had a motor in his bike. You know, all kinds of things, and it's really difficult. We've had some emails as well, and people seeking reassurance. As you said the other day, the most powerful words in journalism are the most important words. Are I don't know. We don't know, but. In term, if you and what Alex Dowsett said there was, if you isolate that performance on that day in those circumstances, you can remove the miraculous aspect, if you like, because what actually happened was that, you know, Team Sky had a strategy for fueling, which they've considered to be very important. It was at a particular stage,
which
in the
we'll
race.
Revisit in a minute.
We'll revisit that in a minute. It was at a particular point in the race, of a very hard race. It wasn't as though Froome was being chased down by teams and a big group behind him. There was Sebastian Reichenbach, Tom Dumoulin, and Thibaut Pinot. And Froome made, this is just slightly disputed, but he made about a minute and a half, but certainly more than a minute on the descents. Now, without the time that he gained on the descents, Dumoulin would be in the pink jersey. And I think Dumoulin made a mistake by, they waited for Reichenbach. And Dumoulin thought, with that distance remaining, and you can understand the thinking that he'd be better with a group around him to help with the chase. And that's what logic tells you. But as you said last night in the podcast, Daniel, it wasn't really that sort of scenario. It was kind of man against man. And, you know, I think, well, Dumoulin would be in pink now, I think, if Dumoulin had just gone for it himself and taking the descents in the way that Froome took the descents.
Well, and just on those circumstances, Rich, the way the descents were ridden yesterday, the fact that the group waited, or Pinot wanted to wait for Reichenbach, Dumoulin made some fairly unflattering comments about Reichenbach's descending last night. He said that Reichenbach had been descending like a grandmother. I spoke to Seb Reichenbach this morning in Susa to get his response.
Oh, après, c'est pas une surprise, hein. Je sais que.
I've always had problems on descent, and obviously the accidents I've had recently haven't improved matters. That said, I don't think if Dumoulin had been alone with Thibaut, he would have gained more time. It's not as though they waited long for me at the bottom of the second descent. I can also understand that he was very frustrated to have to do all of the work or to share it with me. I get that. Me using the Moscon legal case as motivation to chase down Froome yesterday? No, I don't mix those things up. That didn't come into my thinking.
Rich Dumoulin there, you know, who we hail as a very charming speaker, and he's wonderfully accessible to the media. But his comments were actually a little bit insensitive about Reichenbach. If he knows Reichenbach's history, the recent history of his career, he's had some bad crashes, the incident with Moscon last year, and I thought it was very noble of Reichenbach there to hold his hands up and say, yeah, I am a bad descender. But I think he was also pretty cool-headed in his analysis of what it would have changed if they hadn't waited for him. I don't think it would have made that much difference. And in fact, we'll hear later in the episode from one of Dumoulin's teammates, Sam Ooman, who said that the only thing that really would have made a difference to Dumoulin would have been him having a teammate in that situation yesterday.
You're right on about the comments from Tom Dumoulin. I mean, we do like, he's quite edgy, you know, he speaks his mind, and we like that. We wouldn't want him to not do that, but I did find myself imagining today if Chris Froome had come out with comments like that, it would have broken the internet. There's double standards at play here. There's a lot of anti-Froome feeling, and a lot of it owes entirely justifiably to the fact that he's racing here with an unresolved adverse analytical finding.
But I've also seen comments in the last 24 hours that he is shitting on the sport by being here. What he's actually doing is waiting for a case to be resolved. I mean, it's if you imagine receiving some kind of letter notification that a speeding fine is being you've gone over the speed limit, or the police think you've gone over the speed limit and they're considering your case. I mean, do you stop driving in the meantime just in case that they find you guilty? And this process is taking a long time, and it would have taken a long time regardless of the strategy that Sky and Froome adopted. It could have taken months. So is Chris Froome supposed to forsake several months of his career, possibly two Grand Tours. In, let's face it, these are the twilight years of his career. He's not going to have many more chances, but it seems that people would like him for the what they see as the greater good, even if he's innocent, to forsake several months of racing.
I do have sympathy with that view, though. I mean, I do have sympathy with that view. I think it's impossible not to, because for all that you can have also sympathy with Chris Froome, I don't think they're mutually exclusive positions. You can consider that him winning a Grand Tour with this hanging over him, it does leave a bad taste. But the prospect of that left a bad taste for me weeks and even months ago.
But Rich, we know that the result of this Grand, of this Giro is going to stand.
Yes,
we're very confident about that. We've been through, you know, we've discussed the legal implications of him winning the Giro here. There wasn't a pattern of adverse analytical findings with Froome. It was one occasion where he went over the limit. So at this point in time, when we don't know his test results of the Giro, but we have to assume that he's not testing positive every day here. So, you know, to all intents and purposes, the results here are valid while the process is ongoing as regards his Vuelta last year.
Now, Daniel, much was made of the Team Sky fueling strategy. It was a stroke of genius if you were a Sky admirer. It's BS if you're not. They had all the staff out on the road providing feeding. I think you spoke to Mark Reef.
Well, we just thought we'd check this because, as you say, a lot is always made, or a lot has been made, or Sky make a lot themselves of things they do differently from other teams. They had 12 members of staff on the Colette or on yesterday's stage at various points distributing food and liquid to Froome in particular. La Gazzetta dello Sport this morning published an article which would have drawn hoots of derision had it been published in some other quarters about what an advantage it was for Sky to have their soigneurs and mechanics, everyone who was basically giving Chris Froome food in day-glow yellow
high-vis vests.
Yeah, high-vis vests as opposed to the blue vests that they used to use, so Chris Froome could easily see them. This was a huge advantage. But we did suspect that other teams might have done something similar, and particularly Tom Dumoulin's team. So we thought we'd check. So we asked Mark Reef, the coach at Sunweb today, what they did on the Colle delle Finestre as regards nutrition and refueling.
We had nothing special arranged in that sense. We had nutrition already from the start, also in the feeding zone. We also had a guy at the top with bottles and with gels, and we thought that
in
that
terms
was,
of the Colle delle Finestre yesterday and strategies and, you know, whether it made that much of a difference, we don't know. But there is no doubt that Sky put more resources into, and it seems like they dedicated a little bit more time and attention to detail to that particular issue, the refueling nutrition on the Colle delle Finestre yesterday.
I mean, refueling is so clearly so vital, and it gets harder to do the deeper you are into a Grand Tour. Physically, riders find it harder to eat sometimes, the more tired they are. But practically as well, you know, when the racing is really fast at the start, as it was yesterday, you know, and you're lined out, it's difficult to get the food down. And Dowsett, actually, when I speaking to him off the tape, said that does become a real problem.
Well, it seems to have been, we said last night, it's been a theme a couple of times on the Colle delle Finestre with Savoldelli in 2005. So
you sound like Simon Yates.
I do, yeah. Again, it's a lot of it's down to resources. And I remember a stage a few years ago over the Pyrenees. It was a big old day in the Pyrenees. And again, I was speaking to Giuseppe Martinelli, the Astana coach then. And it was a similar scenario where Sky just simply had more people at the race. They had more members of staff and they had more feeds consequently. And even Martinelli on that occasion was saying, well, yeah, it is an advantage for them.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
The sponsor of today's episode from the Giro d'Italia is a new one for us, Moneybox. Moneybox is a simple way to save and invest. It's a mobile-only app that allows you to round up your everyday purchases to the nearest pound and invest the spare change. So when we've been buying our afternoon cappuccinos here in Italy. We can invest the spare change. You can invest in companies such as Netflix, Tesla and Nike via simple tracker funds. Now, Lionel, you've actually been using this for a while.
I have. I was quite excited when I heard that Moneybox wanted to sponsor the podcast, because completely unrelated to their sponsorship, I actually became a Moneybox customer back in November. And the theory is very similar to having a pennies jar or a change jar, where you'd maybe spend a tenner on something and have 75 pence change and you chuck it in a jar. But it works with debit and credit card transactions. So if you buy something in a shop on your card, you get the option on the app to round that purchase up to the nearest pound and chuck that money into your fund. You can also invest a certain amount each week, and you can choose how much you want to invest. And I've been pretty satisfied. It gets invested in all kinds of things that are kind of a bit beyond me, but because you're just choosing how much to chuck in, you're kind of in control of how much you're saving. I would say I went for a kind of medium risk. You know me, I don't like too much speculation. I don't like too much speculation. And over the 6 months or so that I've been using it, you know, like all investments, it kind of goes up and goes down. It's doing pretty well at the moment, so I'm really happy with it.
When I spoke to the Moneybox people, they said it was very popular among millennials and young people, but it's popular among old people too. So join 100,000 people investing in their future with Moneybox. As with all investing, your capital is at risk and you may get back less than you invest. That's Moneybox, the Moneybox app. Visit the App Store or Play Store to download the Moneybox app today. That's Moneybox, the Moneybox app. Visit the App Store or Play Store to download the Moneybox app today.
A San Francisco.
A community around the world. Stories and films with the most compelling characters. The world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Thank you to Rafa. We did run our overall Pedaleur de Charme poll to give the coveted Rafa Pedaleur de Charme t-shirt to our overall Giro 101 Pedaleur de Charme. Simon Yates won the poll, but I didn't feel like I wanted to go up to Simon Yates the morning after he lost the pink jersey and in disastrous circumstances and presented with a t-shirt. I will at some point, but I didn't do it today. I did present to
somebody
else.
We sent Lionel to Andorra, Lionel's favourite place, where Simon Yates lives, on a special assignment to present him with the jersey.
No, we will do it.
Present him with the jersey and some kind of plaque commemorating Lionel's invention of the nickname, his Sanguinaccio Volante, that went down so well with Simon Yates.
I believe Rafa may even have made a special Flying Black Pudding t-shirt. So,
which will never see the light of day, will
it? We might present him with both, and I think further on from this event, when the dust has settled, I think it'll mean more to him. So we will do that at some point. I did make a presentation to the second rider on the poll, and we'll tell you about that tomorrow and post a picture and so on. But why are you looking at me like that?
No. Carry on. Crack on.
Simon Yates was the other big story on Friday, of course. And you spoke to him at the start today, Daniel.
I did.
And Sven Tuft as well.
Yeah, we're going to hear Sven Tuft talking about how Simon Yates had reacted to the body blow he took yesterday, and then Simon Yates this morning in Susa.
He's quite upbeat, eh? Kid's a fighter, so you don't hold people like that down, you know? People are human, and he's starting the stage like it's just another day. So he's got an incredible attitude on life, and that's the true mark of a champion, I think.
Yeah, look, I keep saying this, but at the start, nobody would bet for me to win. I'm proud of what I achieved. Of course, I'm disappointed that I couldn't pull it off, and especially because we're so close. But these Grand Tours are 3 weeks, and you need to be good for 3 weeks. A quote from Matt White when I first joined the team: a GC rider can never have a bad day. I had a bad day. You know, I'm learning. I'm confident I'll be back. It's not like I'm going anywhere, and I'll learn some things from this and take it forward.
Was there a particular moment in the stage where you knew that it wasn't going to go the way you wanted it to, or was it just on the finestre?
I felt all right on the first climb there, and then as soon as Sky started to set the tempo there, I was really in some difficulty. Not to make excuses, but I was really warm as well. It was the first hot day yesterday. Not that this is why I got dropped.
But it's a bit of a change from the...
Exactly, yeah. Just a combination of a few things, of being really tired, a bit of heat. I don't know. I just didn't have it. I'm still short. as if I recovered from yesterday. You know, I was hurting just to get to the finish yesterday, I'll be honest. But we'll see. I'm not the rightful owner of this jersey.
From Simon Yates, and before that from his teammate Sven Tuft. I mean, Yates was, well, he seemed in reasonable humour. I think you take the positives from this already. A few hours after the great disappointment, he seemed to be coming to terms with it, and he will benefit hugely from this experience, I'm sure.
Yeah, his jury is not going to be measured in how many minutes. I mean, I've no idea where he is now on general classification, how many minutes down he finished, but in terms of the days completed in which, you know, when he was leading the race or in very good shape to win the race. And the Giro is a 21-stage race, and he completed 19 stages as effectively the kind of virtual Maglia Rosa.
And what he and his team added to the race in terms of excitement and drama. You know, I mean, they contributed a hell of a lot. They won their fifth stage today with Mikel Nievi, and they came with a very strong team, and they've added a lot. I spoke to Matt White at the finish, the sports director there. Here he is. I mean, Matt, you finish on another high today, but is it too soon to reflect on this Giro and all the ups and downs?
No, I think it's been our best Giro. It's been our best Grand Tour. There's no doubt about that. Been no doubt about that. Obviously, yeah, disappointing to lose Simon the lead so close to the finish. But it's been a great experience for him, great experience for the team. And look, I think we proved to you that we're the best team here. You know, we dominated the race on many, many fronts. Five stage wins from three different riders. And I think the way we went about the wins as well was an aggressive style. It hasn't been seen at the Giro for a long, long, long time. And no, we came here to win fans over and win some stages as well.
How did you feel yesterday, you know, when you got news of Simon's troubles?
Well, I was directly behind him. Yeah. Yeah, it's a bit of a shock, and it sort of gets you down a little bit. But no, 30 minutes later, I was writing schedules, different plans for the second part of the season, thinking what we can do different, and you just got to move on quickly. And we as a team moved on quickly. We had a really good debrief last night, just to set things straight, and how proud we were of the guys. And we wanted to attack today's stage, and we certainly did with the right guy, whose birthday it was as well. So you couldn't have written the script any better.
Was he able to communicate to you that he was feeling tired?
Yeah, look, he went incredibly deep in the time trial, and it really hurt him. Like, he was at the stage there, he had to ask the presentation to be postponed because he was borderline fainting. So we knew he went very, very deep. And then the day after, which was should have been an easy stage, which certainly wasn't, he said he felt okay. He said he felt the first time he'd actually felt tired in the race, and he said he was really jovial about it. Like, if stage 17 is the first day I'm tired, things aren't so bad. And then we got a little bit of a glimpse at the finish there at Parque Novoso, that he said he just couldn't react when the big power went on. And I think it was just an accumulative effect. And when he went that deep in the time trial, he had some minor stomach problems, and that sort of restricted a little bit the food intake he could take those 2 days after. And that, on top of that, and the accumulative stress, it just was the big hammer that fell on him.
Do you take heart from, I mean, Tom Dumoulin obviously won this race last year. He had a similar experience at the Vuelta a couple of years ago where, you know, he was so close to winning it. Yeah. and it just caught up with him at the end. Do you take some heart from that?
Oh, 100%. Simon Yates is one step away, very small step away from winning a Grand Tour. And he's proven already this year he's one of the world's best one-week riders. And when he concentrates on hilly one-day races, he goes okay as well. So, no, he's going to take a lot of confidence out of it. And it was his first Giro as well. You know, the Giro is, and I will always say, it's a very, very different beast to the Tour de France. And whether he comes back next year or we decide to go to the Tour de France, who knows? But he's learned a lot about himself. And as a team, I think we're very proud of his effort and also the team.
So that was Matt White there, looking positively at the Giro and what, you know, their best ever Grand Tour, he said, which is, you know, they've been on the podium before in Grand Tours, thanks to Esteban Chavez. He feels that this was a better overall performance, and they'll learn a lot from it. And I mentioned to him Tom Dumoulin's collapse a couple of years ago, which we forgot to mention, at the Vuelta, when he looked on course to be winning the Vuelta, and with a couple of days to go, he had a bit of a collapse himself and lost over 3 minutes, I think 3.5 minutes or something to Fabio Aru, who won the race. And, you know, he recovered from that, and it took him a couple of seasons, but he won the Giro last year. So it's a huge body blow, you know, I think, to Simon Yates, and a huge psychological blow. But he's only 25, and he's got a big future ahead of him.
Yeah, and you know, we've seen a couple of huge collapses now in the last 2 days. So Pino today and Simon Yates yesterday, and it really just underlines again how difficult this Giro has been. The on reflection, when Mauro Vegni sits down after the Giro and thinks back on how this race has gone, he might decide that it was even a little bit too hard, as much because of the transfers, some of the difficult timings. I mean, there were a lot of riders who were pretty unhappy this morning to be at the start. Well, the buses showed up to the start today at about 9 o'clock, having had a late finish yesterday when they got down off the mountain Bardonecchia in cable cars pretty late. And there were definitely murmurings, or more than murmurings, of discontent. And you know, we talked in the car earlier, didn't we, Rich, about the kind of stress that Simon Yates has had to put up with, just in terms of the post-race protocol, which he's dealt with pretty smoothly, pretty easily, he seemed to, but there's still obligations. There's you know, there's a mix zone, there's press conference, and in terms of stress level and stimulation, there's a big difference between that and just sort of kicking back in the team bus and heading to the team hotel, and he had to put up with that for 2 weeks.
Daniel, you also spoke to, I think, Sam Omen. Tom Dumoulin's teammate played a vital role for him today, and he's ridden extremely well. He's only 22 years old. He was riding well at the Vuelta last year before he fell sick, but he has come of age here. Three under 25 riders in the top 10 here at this Giro, which bodes well for those guys, and he is set to finish ninth overall.
A slight note of regret, I think, from Sam Omen, that he wasn't of more help to Tom Dumoulin yesterday, particularly on the stage at Bardonecchia. Lawrence Ten Dam is a rider at the other end of the age scale and at the other end of his career, a guy who a couple of years ago wanted
grizzled. Grizzled.
Yeah, I would say so. I don't think he'd mind us saying that. A couple of years ago, he was ready to give up professional cycling. He'd had experience as a leader, and it all sort of gone south for him. But he's had a new lease of life, so we're going to hear from him as well.
I also wondered myself if we could have done something different. And I think only yesterday was a critical moment on Finestre, and he needed somebody there in the final and to keep the gap close to Froome, somebody like me, but I was not able to follow the best five guys on the Finestre. So
I'm proud of my men, both Tom and Sam. Two Dutch guys, it's nice to chaperon and over the mountains when you're 37 years old. I have some bonus years in my career after 2016, and I'm enjoying them to the max. And last year we won, this year we got second, but I'm as proud as last year. So yeah, we fought from Jerusalem to Rome, and if this is the result, this is it. And I think we can be happy with that. Happy with this team. I was a little bit fed up with cycling end of 2015, went 1 year to the US, and 2018-27, but still back in business, and hope to continue for one or two more years. So happy. And it's really an honor to race for guys like Sam and Tom.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Independent research shows 10% of sports nutrition products would get a professional rider banned. Trust Science in Sport, the world's highest standard of banned substance testing.
Thank you to Science and Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. And a reminder, you can get 25% off all your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25. Now, a few other loose ends to tie up in this.
Buffalo
part.
Tasting notes. We had another bottle of Barbera last
night. Pizza last night, wasn't it?
Yeah, but we had a a fairly decent bowler, Barbera. Did you make any? Did you any observations?
I think I taught you a little bit about how to let a wine breathe, didn't I?
You don't really understand the concept. You had a full pint of what they call a large beer, these parts, and then you insisted on having a full glass of wine waiting for you. And I tried to explain the concept of oxygenation of wine and the surface and the importance of surface area. But you were having none of it.
What do you mean?
Well, the surface area in a bottle.
You didn't try to explain.
Well, I would have. Wait, I couldn't get a word in edgeways. But the surface area of an open bottle, the amount of wine that's in contact with the air in a bottle, is almost identical to what was in your glass yesterday. So it made absolutely no difference that you were claiming that the wine was breathing beautifully, that it was flourishing.
At the risk of sounding really stupid, it's not going to be in contact with more air in a glass than in a bottle with a thin neck.
It was the same amount as
a bike rider, a cyclist opens his mouth wide to breathe.
If the diameter of the glass is bigger, but it wasn't in this case. It was
quite a big glass.
No, it wasn't.
Big fishbowl. That's the way I like it. So those are my tasting notes for tonight. What else happened in the bike race today?
Poor old Thibaut Pinot.
Pinot Noir.
Pinot didn't go down. Think of a snappy.
I think he was corked.
Pinot was corked today. No, I think he was ill actually. We're getting live updates actually, Rich, from the Groupama FDJ camp, and there is talk of an illness, and I think he's being examined by the doctor at the moment, but he was dropped pretty badly. I didn't expect him to suffer so much today. There has also been talk that yesterday was a hotter day, and this was something that Simon Yates mentioned to us this morning, that this has been quite a chilly or cool Giro as far as the weather's concerned, certainly compared to last year. Yesterday was the first day when I think...
And who likes the heat?
Well, the temperature was above 25 degrees. Who does like the heat? Chris Froome. Pinot, I think, the team seemed to think, got a bit too hot under his collar yesterday and suffered as a result today. But
it goes back to the fueling thing, doesn't it? Because, you know, in a Grand Tour, you're not fueling just for that day, you're fueling for the next day. And if he had problems fueling, refueling during the stage yesterday, he'd have paid for it today. I mean, Chris Froome was fueling yesterday for that stage, but also for today. It was a surprise because I thought Pinot looked really good on Friday. And sad because he looked on the cusp of the podium. He just missed out last year.
Yeah, and it's been an emotional rollercoaster for him over the last few days.
I spoke to George Preidler, his teammate this morning, who said, you know, mentioned, and we'll hear from him tomorrow, but we heard from him earlier on as well, but he said that, you know, if you could have seen on the bus the ups and downs, the roller coaster that we've been on, which suggested that it has been quite a rocky road.
And I think Pinot really dictates the mood in that team because he is quite an introverted character at times, and his moods vary a lot according to how well things are going, and he was very, very down. I mean, I was around the bus on the day after the time trial. He was very, very down. Yesterday, things started to be going, seemed to be going in the right direction again. He was back on the podium. And then today, again, around the team vehicles after the finish, it was a very somber atmosphere. But I think more than anything else, he faces this quandary that he wants to continue doing the Giro because I think that's the grand tour that he thinks he can win in the future.
I'm going to give a shout out to good friend of the podcast, Moyin Islam, who is a big Pinot fan. I know Moyin's taking this badly. So Moyin, chin up. I'm sure Pinot will bounce back.
Just before I go on, Rich, that reminds me, our two Canadian, the lovely Canadian couple we met last week. Where were we? We were in the mountains somewhere. I can't even remember where we were a week ago.
Zoncolan.
Sapada. I think it was their 20th wedding anniversary on Thursday. I've got their names written down, but I can't quite remember. But anyway, happy anniversary.
Brilliant.
Sorry. They'll know who they are. Pinot, yeah, I think he faces this quandary that he wants to carry on doing the Giro. His team will want him to do the Tour de France. It's a tricky one. I don't think he really wants to go back to the Tour de France too much.
No, the the other big battle today was for the white jersey. That's been a good race that we've probably not spoken about much. And it's interesting to think, isn't it, how that has impacted on the overall race, because those two were with Pino and Dumoulin on Friday, but sitting on, because they were kind of racing each other. And so, you know, they didn't have the same incentive to try and catch Froome that Dumoulin and Pino had. And that has had an effect on the overall outcome of the race, I would suggest, because today, again, they were both strong and attacking each other and, you know, ending up third and fourth on GC.
And as the riders waited to be whisked away to their flight in Turin, which will be leaving around about now to go to Rome, I spoke to the Astana director sportif, so Miguel Angel Lopez's director sportif, and multiple Giro winner as a DS, Beppe Martinelli.
More than the white jersey is the podium that's really gratifying. This morning we could harbour some hope of getting the white jersey, maybe missing the podium by a few seconds, but to nick that third place with a 24-year-old kid is really gratifying. He's still a boy, but a boy in the real sense of the word. He's not fully confident in the team, but that's also normal for a kid who's riding as a leader with a big team behind him for the first time. Initially, he was a little bit overwhelmed by it all. When I say he wasn't confident in the team, I mean he was scared. He's scared of having a team behind him and not living up to the responsibility. We tried not to put pressure on him in the first few days because it's easy to get something wrong there. We knew in the last week of this Giro all hell would break loose, and that's what's happened. Because this Giro really was too hard. We've seen in the last 2 or 3 years that the Giro is decided in the last 2, maximum 3 days. You can only lose it before then. I don't remember a day when it wasn't eyeballs out from kilometre zero. Why? Because we're all in the same mad scramble nowadays. Whole stages are on TV, so teams want that airtime and that publicity, which is only right, especially for the small teams. But this means the first hour is ridden at a crazy pace. Today we did 40 kilometres an hour in the first hour. It's like some guys don't even look at the profile anymore. Unfortunately, this is just the way things are. We've all got access to the best technology, the best ideas, and we all think these things bring us within striking distance of massive success. What this does is raise the level, bring everyone closer together, and it becomes very hard to get ahead of the competition, unless there's a collapse.
Thought Martinelli was fascinating there, Rich. Just talking about how intense this Giro has been and the effect that TV coverage is having on that, and also the fact that so many teams now, you know, we talked about Sky maybe being a step ahead yesterday in terms of feeding, but how most of the teams now are very attentive to details, and they're also convinced that by being even more attentive to details, they can turn riders, transform riders from good riders to great riders, and everyone is chasing that extra percent, that extra element, that extra sort of infinitesimal
yeah, give you that
fraction of something, and it leads to, well, it maybe it feeds into what we've been hearing for a few days now, that this Giro has been pretty much from the gun every day, eyeballs out racing.
Full gas. Well, I spoke to Victor Delaparte, the Movistar rider, whose teammate Richard Carapaz has been one of the revelations of this race and was battling Lopez for the white jersey. Here he is at the finish, Victor Delaparte. Had a big job today, obviously, to try and help Richard. He missed out, obviously, on the white jersey, but you must be pleased with how he's ridden this race.
Yeah, I think the goal was now the white jersey. He did a really, really good race. So we tried to put him in the podium. It was so difficult that we do all the best.
Has it been a surprise to you how well he's ridden?
Yeah, we didn't know that he was so strong in this big race. So I think until now he will be a reference in the world peloton.
So Movistar, 4 Grand Tour overall contenders now, maybe 5.
Yeah, I think we will see. But
so Daniel, really the ultimate day of the Giro,
Champions League finals just starting behind us.
Can you hear the
Champions
League familiar theme? Yeah, we'll go and get dinner somewhere and watch that. I mean, I get the feeling that there's a lot of hand-wringing out there. I mean, I think we dealt with that a little bit in part one.
Very difficult to deal with it all, but I don't feel as though we're any more enlightened about where the sport is at and where the credibility of the sport is at than we were 48 hours ago. You take away issues that predate this Giro, the Salbutamol case, the Wiggins case, and all of those questions that Sky are facing. There was nothing inherent in what Froome did yesterday to justify some of the shrill reaction today, in my opinion.
What I would say is that to anybody who, we have had emails from people sort of looking for reactions, I can't give that, but I can say that people on Twitter don't know. And if people on Twitter tell you that they know, they're lying. That's all I would say. People don't know. We don't know. They don't know. And the other thing, a lot of this does go back to Froome's miraculous emergence as a GC rider in 2011. And this sort of links to the Landis comparison as well. Floyd Landis was 30 years old. He'd won Paris-Nice. That was it, pretty much. He'd been a teammate of Lance Armstrong's. He didn't have a Grand Tour pedigree, a pedigree of winning Grand Tours or placing on the podium of Grand Tours. I'd like to also just mention Tom Dumoulin because, there does seem to be a lot of love out there for Tom Dumoulin. Dumoulin was a professional for, I think, 7 years before he won the Giro last year, and he was 27 years old. Froome was 26 years old when he finished on the podium at the Vuelta, and he'd been professional, I think, for 4 years. So this idea that he he'd been a professional for many years and that he was in his sort of late 20s is kind of false. And really, with 5 Grand Tours having been won since, we shouldn't really still be harking back to that, but we are, I think.
And Rich, I think in our little sequence of reactions to Froome's performance yesterday, for the most part, riders completely picked at random or directors, sportifs, team managers picked at random. I don't sense any great bitterness or any great cynicism or any great scepticism about Chris Froome. I think there are a lot of guys who are unhappy that he's here. They're unhappy with the way his Salbutamol case has been dealt with. And there are riders in the MPCC teams, for example, who think about what would happen if they were in this situation and they wouldn't be here, and that makes them unhappy. However, I don't get the sense that there are a lot of riders in the peloton that think they're being cheated and that the Froome dynasty is a heist.
Just to correct myself, Dumoulin was 26 when he won the Giro, and it was his sixth year as a professional before anybody corrects me. We don't support anybody. We're not, in saying what I've just said, I'm not trying to advocate for Chris Froome or say that I believe that he's clean. I don't know, and we don't know, and we're completely neutral in terms of the riders and the teams and so on. Or we try to be, we strive to be. We have people we like, I think, don't we? Don't we, Daniel?
We have people we know more about.
We have people we know more about.
People we have more contact with than others.
Absolutely. Anyway, we should wrap things up. We will be back tomorrow for a final Giro d'Italia podcast. We may have a little contribution there from our old friend Napalm, the line of the chilled turns. Lionel Burney, we'll try and get him on. He's been desperate to come and say something. He's had lots of thoughts, I think, about the last few days. So we'll get something from Lionel tomorrow, and we'll hear from lots of other people as well. That's all for now. Let's go and watch the Champions League.
Ciao.
That's football, yeah?
Oh, my word.
A community around the world. Stories and films with the most compelling characters. The world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa. Ci chiude nella tenevo giardina.